We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm Mike Graves, and hopefully we're all in the right place. Let's talk about the sermon and the short story. Everybody do their homework?
Yes.
Really?
You didn't expect that.
Wow.
I was going to try and pull it up here, and they won't let us.
Oh, they won't?
No.
Well, I have to apologize. It's not my fault, but I'm sorry that one of the stories crashed. Did you have that experience?
Yes, Cathedral.
Yeah, Cathedral crashed. When I sent this in with the link, Cathedral, the whole thing was online. And then by the time the thing went to press, somebody emailed, made some in this room, and said, it's only got the first page. And so somehow or another, that Raymond Carver story that was on there just disappeared. I don't know if they're just baiting us or what, which is a really shame, because I love that story. But maybe some of you have read it, and we'll see if we can talk about it or not. It's probably for the best, because I was probably biting off more than I could chew, trying to do two stories in an hour. A couple of things as we get started. I do have an email sign-up sheet for you. Not that I need pen pals, but if you're interested, don't put your name down if you're not. You don't have to feel obligated. I've been collecting what I would call preachable short stories for 10 years. I've read thousands, and I've only come up with about 75. Now, you might read others and say, well, this will preach too, but this was a pretty selective group. So if you're interested, because I am working on a book by this title, The Sermon and a Short Story, so that's going to be the index in the back of the book is here are all those stories. Now, unfortunately, they're not all available online, but you know, at least we know where to go. So if you want to do that, you can. You just put your name and email, and I'll send it to you.
You're sending a list of the stories you've read that you thought were preachable.
Right. Yeah.
But not the stories
themselves. No, not the stories themselves. You know, the problem with the stories themselves is, even in the book, it cost me money to put them in there. I have permission from Alice Walker to put in one, and I'm going to try to get permission to put in a couple others, but it costs a lot of money. Yeah. And I don't get rich doing these things anyway, so trust me. I think you get like $1 a book. Not very good. I absolutely love this topic. Okay, I don't know if I can do it justice in an hour, and we're only gathered around this one story, but hopefully I can at least communicate some of my own excitement about it. I'm teaching a class this semester, starts next Tuesday. It's not too late for you to enroll. called The Sermon and the Short Story. And I just can't wait, because it is so much fun. It's so unlike other seminary classes. I teach, by the way, at St. Paul's School of Theology in Kansas City. And, you know, what normal seminary classes are like, some of you, not necessarily all of you. And this one's just totally different. We read short stories every week, and we try to go and find a biblical text that if you set it next to this, the two could kind of create some sparks and maybe get a sermon going. And it's just really, really fun. So we'll talk a little bit about that methodology of setting this next to that kind of thing as well. So, you see on the top there, I've got these two quotes. I love the one from John Irving. He was actually quoting a French writer at the time, and I have not been able to track down the French writer, but God doesn't care at all what we write, but when we get it right, God can use it. I just love that, because there's no doubt about it. Some of these short story writers, and of course many, many other writers and novelists, some of them don't give a flip about writing for God, and yet so often they can write some stuff that can definitely be used. I think a classic example, anybody read Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth? Yeah, it's like this 1,000-page novel. And Follett writes spy novels, and he is not Christian. In fact, he's anti, pretty much. But his best-selling novel, and it kind of confounds him, is a book about a church builder in the 12th century. And it sort of ticks him off that this religious book has caught on. But it's not rated G religious, so, you know, buyer beware. But the point of that quote for me is that there are some of these short stories that on the surface you would say, well, that's religious. In fact, you know the name Paul Tillich, theologian, philosopher? Paul Tillich actually did a kind of a taxonomy, and he was relating it to artwork, visual print art. But it works for short stories. He said there are stories, we'll say it that way, that on the surface are religious, but underneath really aren't. You know, kitsch kind of stuff. And then there's stories on the surface that aren't religious, and underneath they're not. And I'm not really interested in those two categories. But the other two categories, which are fairly predictable, is there can be religious on the surface, like, say, a Flannery O'Connor who has lots of stuff going on, but it's also religious underneath. And then my favorite is the ones that are not necessarily religious on the surface, but are underneath. And using Tillich's definition of ultimate concern, they deal with things that really matter to people. So that's kind of the spirit for me of the John Irving quote. And then the Fred Craddock quote, you know, you got to have a Craddock quote, it's not preaching. He is the one who said that the sermon and the short story are cousins. They're cousins. And in all of his years of teaching preaching, he had his students read a short story every week. They didn't do anything with it. They just read them. Because he was convinced it would make them better preachers. So, for me, I'm going to go pretty quickly through the sound of mosquitoes coughing, which is what Christopher Stendahl, the biblical scholar, called apologetics. And what he meant by
that?
No.
Oh.
What he meant by that is that it's fairly insignificant. You know, mosquitoes coughing, if you can imagine a mosquito coughing, it's pretty insignificant. Well, and his point is, if you're already convinced, you don't need apologetics, and if you're not, apologetics probably won't convince you. It's about as persuasive as a mosquito coughing. So anyway, but, you know, these are pretty good selling points. I mean, not that you need them, you're in the room, right? Source of illustrations. What preacher is not desperate to find stories for Sundays? And by the way, I should ask, how many of you are in the preacher boat side of the equation? Okay, and what about the non-preacher boat? What do you do? What are you interested in? Literature? Yeah? What would you think about sermons? You're a non-preacher. What would you think about sermons that invoked good short stories? Would that, you'd like it?
Okay. That story is a good story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and in my preaching class, one of the criteria for evaluating a sermon is the use of good illustrative material as opposed to canned preacher stories. You know, like if you Google illustrations for Sunday and desperatepreacher.com or, you know, whatever it is, most of those stories are just anemic. Right? You know the ones I'm talking about? A farmer was plowing his field when he, you know, and just right away you know, this doesn't seem real at all. As I mentioned earlier, cousin to narrative preaching, I think narrative preaching and the short story have a lot in common. They're trying to do something. Narrative preaching is not exclusively interested, as some people would say, in just entertaining or keeping people interested. It is interested in that. You know, narrative preaching thinks that maybe the whole sermon ought to be interesting, not just the stories. But it also can learn from the short story because of the way stories work. You know, Eugene Lowry, who taught where I teach now for years, who's kind of the pioneer of narrative preaching, said that the real definition of a narrative sermon is not how many stories are in it, but that the sermon overall is story-like. And what he meant by that is it has plot. It moves from complication to resolution. And that when sermons don't start with complication, people tune out pretty quick. I mean, I just borrowed a novel that I'm reading on the trip. And the guy said, trust me, you'll love it. You'll be hooked after the first few pages. Well, why? Because there's complication. And I'm trying to figure out, is this Mafia Don going to knock off this family? I don't know. If I knew, there'd be no reason reading it. And short stories, of course, are brilliant at that. They're not going to start by telling you the butler did it, if it's a mystery or whatever. So, cousin to narrative preaching. Brevity is a good selling point, not just because if we're going to use them in the sermon, and they need to be fairly brief, but also because we can read them in, you know, a fairly short amount of time, so that the person who says, I just don't have much time for reading, well, it doesn't take much. Hitchcock said that the movie and the short story are the closest related, not the novel. because it would hold you in its grip at one sitting. Whereas the novel, you're going to come back. And the short story, you know, for the most part, you read any short story in an hour or less. So brevity is a good selling point. High on my list would be the next one, though, the feeding of our souls. Preachers' souls are just terribly bare at times. And, you know, one of the reasons, among many, would be the lack of reading. I could list a lot of other things, too, but this kind of reading can really speak to your soul. I mean, one of the, I don't even have to say it other than to say, you know, those 75 or whatever stories I've got in this index now, one of the ways they got in there is that when I got through, I was moved. You know, there was this, oh my gosh, you know, kind of feeling, but it touched you in a deep level. So that's kind of a nice one. And then probably my number one reason would be real life honesty. You know, these writers are so much more honest than preachers are. Which is sad, because preachers would say, are you kidding? You know what kind of life they live? But I'm talking about their stories. Their stories are true, even when they're fiction, because they're so true to life. And so many sermons, well, you know, it just doesn't seem very true to life. And in particular here, I'm thinking that the real-life honesty of these stories is an antidote to, you know, should I say it this way, maybe the church's biggest heresy. Maybe it's, you could argue for another one, okay? So if you want to nominate a better heresy, we can have the People's Choice Awards of heresies. But it would be Gnosticism. And in particular, docetic Gnosticism. Okay, so, I mean, if you didn't go to seminary, or even if you didn't, you forgot the answers, Gnosticism was one of the early competing philosophies of Christianity, and it infiltrated Christianity. And it had lots and lots of complicated things, but one of the tenets was that there were two gods. And that one god was good, and one god was bad, and this dualism kind of competing. But the bad god was also this god of the flesh. Flesh is bad stuff. Spiritual things, that's what really matters. You know, one day we'll all play a harp in heaven. That's what really matters. This stuff down here, it's tainted. And docetic Gnosticism, from the Greek for to appear, referred to a kind of Christology. And the Christology was, well, Christ, he was Son of God, but he wasn't really human. And they say he appeared to be human, but he wasn't human. If he walked on the seashore of Galilee, he wouldn't make footprints in the sand, which would kill that old illustration, wouldn't it? I mean, but the point was that that's such a high view of his divinity that they sacrificed his humanity. And that is still very rampant in Christianity. The guy that gave me a ride in on the shuttle from the airport yesterday, he's a humanities literature major. And so I said, well, guess what I'm doing a workshop on? So we had a little discussion, and I brought this up, and he said, yeah, it's really strange. He said, but Christians are just afraid of too much humanity. And it's true. In this class that I'll teach this semester, I guarantee you this will happen. We're going to read some theology. We're going to read some biblical stuff, and we're going to read these short stories. And yes, the theology will be hard. I mean, there'll be times they go, I'm not sure what they meant by such and such. But in the short story, they'll go, ooh, I didn't like that, because I know exactly what they meant. You know? Why did that woman have to bare her breast? I said, I'm not the writer, but do you think that happens in the world? Well, yeah, but I didn't. Well, yeah, yeah. And so there's this incredible dis-ease with humanity. They don't like a Jesus who could cry. You know, and remember the carol, no crying he makes, the little baby doesn't cry, of course. And I'm thinking Mary's going, yeah, right. You come to our house tonight and see what you think. So to me, the answer to this docetic Gnosticism is a sacramental theology, which means you embrace the goodness of creation. and that you remember that Genesis 1, where God pronounces it all very good, comes before Genesis 3. And Genesis 3 doesn't undo Genesis 1. It is still very good. And Christ takes on human flesh. Very good stuff. Very good stuff. So, any thoughts, reflections so far? We're gonna get to the story here in just a minute. Okay. I'm actually going to jump down to the very bottom. This set next to that, juxtaposition. That's really the methodology that I use for teaching this class that I'm teaching, and it's the way I think about putting together these sermons. You know, it's a little bit artificial in that, and this will make sense to the preachers, most of us don't read a short story and say, ooh, that'll preach, I need to find a text. Most of us read text, lectionary or not, and go, man, I got to have a story for this. This is good. This is getting me, but I need a text for this. And so it's a little bit artificial to say, let's start with this story and see if we can find a text. But the truth is, if we're honest, you can do eisegesis either way. You can read into a text what you want, regardless of where you start. So we need to be intellectually honest and say, regardless of where we start, we want to read out of, I would say, the story and the text as honestly and as accurately as we can. But the methodology is, when you read this short story, is there a text that you think, wow, this could work? And it's not that it's one-for-one correspondence. You know, you don't say, you're in Luke 15, you go, gosh, all I need is a story, a short story about a guy that had two sons, and one of them took his estate. You know, well, you're not really looking for a short story. You're looking for some kind of contemporary version of the prodigal. So I think it's richer when the story set next to the text isn't so apparent one-for-one correspondence as much as at its very core, here's something. And at this very core, boy, this really has a chance. Could be they're opposites. Could be there's, you know, kind of an antagonism working. But it's just that creative spark. And obviously for a setting like this, we can only go one direction. We can't say, well, let's start with a biblical text and see if we can go find a short story. So, you know, we're kind of going backwards, but it'll work. Okay, so here's what I want us to try and do. We've read God's goodness, right? By Marjorie Kemper. Everybody on the same page?
Go through the plot, because I tried to read like, you know, four or five of them, and I got pieces of a lot of them.
Okay.
So tell me again what the story was about.
Well, that's kind of what we're going to do when we start.
Okay. And I'll catch up when you can do it.
Okay. But it's about Ling Tan, who is helping this boy, Mikey, who's terminal cancer. Does that ring a bell? Einstein poster on the wall over the bed. That's bad if you don't remember that part.
Yeah, it is.
That's okay. That's okay. Well, here's what I want to try and do, though, is let's try in small groups, like two or three, to work through each of these sections, and we'll just do it for like 5 minutes or so, and then we'll do it collectively and see what we can generate. I don't want it to just be, let's do it collectively at first, because there'll be people who talk and people who don't, and I want to see if we can get everybody talking. And then collectively we can kind of share. So why don't we do this in the groups of two or three? Let's start with the literary questions. You don't have to go through all of them, you know, point by point. Personally, I think one of the best discussion starters for a short story is that second question. What scenes are revelatory? It's like watching a movie. When someone comes out and you go to eat afterwards, you say, can you believe that scene where or that part where? Well, what you need to ask yourself when that happens is not just, yeah, that just really ticked me off or that upset me or whatever, is to say, why? Why did that scene do that to you? What's going on? You know, it's a revelation. What's the revelatory piece there? If God is saying something to your spirit through that scene, why is that? So, you know, you might want to do that one or the basic plot. Tone or texture. I like that one. My students, you know, if there's a non-literary background, they kind of look at me like a calf looking at a new post, you know, they're just kind of not sure. And I say, well, think of it as how the story feels or how it makes you feel. And maybe sometimes it's a texture switch. You know, it was going along like this, and then all of a sudden, it just got sticky. I mean, that's a good word. You know, or it got messy, or it got whatever it might be. And then, of course, another really important question, both homiletically, because we can learn something from it, but also from a literary standpoint, how does it end? I mean, that's big for a writer. They don't just, you know, all of a sudden stop typing and say, well, I guess I'll just stop there. I mean, they crafted this thing, and what difference does it make that it ends there? What's the impact of that happening? Okay, so let's try that for a few minutes, small groups, and then we'll talk collectively. Have you made enough progress so we can do it collectively? Maybe? You feel like you've made some progress? Okay, well, let's try it collectively then.
Okay. Because I want to be reading it as much as you could.
Yeah, no, I did. You did a good job. You didn't know you were going to be quick.
Do we need to rehash the basic plot, or do we have that pretty much? If we've read it, we pretty much got it. So let's talk about scenes that are revelatory. What do you think? Any nominations? Yeah.
This is just a brief, two line, but I found when Mike asks her at one point, do you still believe in God's goodness? Maybe it's just that line. But that it matters to him whether she believes, even though he's not going to pick that up.
Right.
And it matters to him a lot what she believes on that.
Yeah, that's an important scene. Yep.
So for me, the interplay of her with nature and flowers and the beauty outside and opening the curtains and the mother's out there and she says, wave to your mother.
Yeah, flowers are pretty important here, aren't they? The nature things going on.
It's sunshine too.
But remember the what was interesting, when do you learn that she likes to do that? It's like on the second page, the flowering plums were beautiful. If Ling looked only at their canopies, if Rye didn't follow the scaling trunks down to the array of old paint cans and junk lumber nestled in the weeds beneath. So even there, the author says, well, it depends where you're looking. You know, you could watch the news and see beauty, or you could watch the news and see disaster, or you could watch nature. And so, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Even early on, Ling's got a selective vision at first, doesn't he? And so does Mike, right? He tends to look at the paint cans, doesn't he? Of course, he's got terminal cancer. What else?
Was that scene where Mike tells his father that they've been praying for miracles, and Mike says he's doing it just thought his dad would get a kick out of it. But, you know, in the short amount of conversation time they have, this is what's going on in Mike's life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the significant thing for him now.
How would you describe their relationship, Mike and Ling's? How would you describe it initially? What do you think?
It's pretty surface. I mean, she just says, you know, smile, be happy, and you're going to get better.
Do you think she believes that and is just naive, or do you think she doesn't really care about him? Or?
I think she believes.
Yeah. And how does he feel toward her? Yeah, and slowly but surely, they have this incredible relationship, don't they? It gets very tender. What else? Any other scenes revelatory for you?
I think the last scene where she sticks her tongue out at Einstein's poster and just in the depth of this kind of sorrow and almost a sense of realism, you know, God answered their prayers in different ways. There's still a hope and a joy that's there under the surface and somehow still connected.
So you read it as hope and joy?
Mm-hmm.
What else? You think somebody else, did anybody else read it differently? There's no right or wrong here.
I read read it more as her kind of disillusionment with God, kind of she was sticking her tongue out at God in that poster on her way out.
Yeah, because it's really interesting how she says it, the author. "Goodbye, Mr. Genius," she said softly. Then before she sailed out the door, that's a very telling verb there, "and in recognition or solidarity or maybe just farewell," Ling stuck out her little pink tongue. It's interesting for an author to say, or maybe it was this, or maybe it was that. I mean, you're the author. You're supposed to be omniscient narrator, right? But isn't that wonderful to keep that kind of mystery so that it's sort of open-ended? I mean, somebody's reading it and says, well, there's still hope and joy. Maybe somebody else is, I don't know. Sticking out the tongue is a pretty telling thing, though.
Part of you read it, but... because in a way, Ling's sticking her tongue out a lot of things in this story. I mean, she's sticking her tongue out at Mike's cynicism. She sticks her tongue out of the way at the father when he says, we don't need any of that stuff. We brought in all the counselors and everything like that. And even at the whole, you know, she keeps opening the curtains and keeps saying, look outside. God made this for you. And even, I mean, yeah, he dies, but she opens the window. She's in the room. And she goes, and it's sort of an open-ended thing, like, what? So where does she go next, you know,
right.
And what difference does her faithfulness, even though it's sticking her tongue out at, what the world serves up, that's sad and hard and painful.
Yeah. Such a brilliant touch to take this Einstein and Hegel and this empiricist stuff, and then to twist this Einstein who has this godlike look, and you know, that's a pretty complex little move there. But.
Well, even the act of sticking the tongue out can be perceived in many different ways, as an insult, or, you know, as something you do maybe to a little kid, playful, joking.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because, I mean, at the very least, the author gives us three options. Recognition, solidarity, farewell, and we might read others. What about texture? It's hard to put into words things like this. Have any adjectives that stand out for you? How did it make you feel when you read it? Do you remember?
That's the question Mike asked.
Do what?
That's the question that the psychiatrist asked Mike.
That's right. It's the question the psychiatrist asked Mike. How does that make you feel? Yeah. Well, I'm sort of asking that one in a literary standpoint, not the psychological one, you know, the counseling. But do you remember? I mean, I remember how I felt, but...
Yeah. I mean, puzzled.
Puzzled? Okay.
Yeah, I think what struck me is the way that the story cross-pollinates very simple worldviews. So that by the end of the story, the two central characters are changed from very simple in some respects to very complicated. Both of them are changed by their interaction with one another around the Book of Job.
Yeah.
In particular, I think.
Right.
So that they're each less certain by the end. And I think that's part of what's going on in the last lines.
Yeah, and we got to come back to that notion when we start talking homiletics. What are we going to do with that? What about not just the way you felt when it's over, but the roller coaster it took you on? Did you have other feelings besides the ones you're saying overall? Yeah.
It never let you out of the room either. So you signed up for the roller coaster ride, you never got off. And that way it forced you simplicity into the tough question.
Yeah. That's a really good observation. Where, you know, it's not like I'll make a hospital visit and then I can get out of here. We're in this hospice and we're stuck there. Of course, we're not stuck there the way Mike is. But yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Well, and in conventional Christian narrative terms, you expect to get
that. Yeah, I know. I remember the first time I read it, there's just this little, you know, like a couple of hard returns before the death is announced. And when I read that, I thought, no, you can't. You know, I mean, the author's done this to us, right? I didn't see that coming. I really didn't. But that's what I was saying earlier. It's real. I mean, not that there aren't healings. There are. But odds are, I'm pretty sure most of us are going to die. I'm just, you know, pretty sure. What about that end? Do we need to say any more about how does it end and what does that, where does that take us? Okay, well then let's try the next section. In your small groups there, the theological questions. What glimpses of deity do we sense? Because some of the stories that you might read, there's no overt mention of God. Raymond Carver's Cathedral, very, very, very much in passing. In this one, of course, we've got the book of Job. What does it say about the human condition? What does it say about sin redemption? Any other questions theologically that come to you? Where do we see grace breaking in? Let's try those for a few minutes, and then we'll share. Okay, let's try this one together. We gotta keep moving or we won't make it to the end. This one's a little easier than a story like Cathedral or some others where God's not necessarily on the surface. I mean, we don't... So glimpses of deity are not quite as hard, but anybody want to jump on that one or any of the others listed there? We obviously have the one big one that's just, you know, glaring is the problem of evil and suffering. The Odyssey. So that one's just front and center with wisdom literature of Job. It's kind of nice when short story writers even throw you a text. they don't usually do that, but there are a few. This one's a little easier than the others. What'd you come up with theologically? What do you, anything that somebody in your group said and you thought, wow, that is really good? Everybody gets quiet. Where do you see grace breaking in? That's an important question. Where's the grace?
Changing Mike's outlook on life.
Changing Mike's outlook? Yeah, he is transformed, isn't he? I'm not sure I'd call it a conversion, but maybe an epiphany of some sort.
Just even in Lynn's presence, she was there the whole way through. It's a really tough thing to do with 16 years old cancer.
Yeah.
Her parents
could. Yeah. That's a good point.
And then there's that sense, too, with Ling that she's not content to just wait for him to die. There's a little life every day. There's that, you know, the flowers out the window, whatever it is. There's always something each day that's worth looking at. And, you know, from the oncologist to the way Mike is at first to the parents, it just seems like everybody's just waiting for the inevitable and not seeing anything in the meantime.
It's interesting, too, that she uses the line the author does about their conspiratorial glances between each other when he's kind of tricking the psychologist. You know, like death warmed over, et cetera. And he's pulling those little jokes, but when she tells us this was conspiratorial between them, you kind of get the idea that it's not just a conspiratory, you know, glance, or it's not just conspiracy against psychologists, but almost like they're conspiring against death or evil. And then, oh, that line, where's that line about maybe Job is beautiful if not about you? Remember that line? She says that? That's powerful. I mean, how many times have we preached or thought about evil and suffering and said there are three things you need to know, you know, and maybe sermons are a whole lot easier for people who aren't suffering to talk about suffering than somebody who's in the midst of suffering. And this story, that's what I'm saying about the real life honesty. This story is not a 3-point sermon on the problem of evil and suffering. All 3 points begin with the letter P, and you know, it's just not that neat and nice. Why don't we try the homiletical questions together out loud? The first one's an obvious yes, or I wouldn't have put it in here, right? I think it'll preach. Let me put it that way. So And the second one's pretty easy too, although you don't have to be limited to Job. You certainly could bring in others, and I guess most of us would say that if you're dealing with evil and suffering, you probably want to have a bigger scope than just one kind of theology, the wisdom theology. But, you know, just for the sake of beyond this story, thinking about that, when you read something like, how many of you read Raymond Carver's Cathedral, by the way? I'm just curious. Yeah, just a few people did. There's no obvious scripture text that jumps out of Cathedral. You kind of read that story. It's so good. It's so good.
Back to the first question, will it preach? It seems to me, or for me at this point, the story only preaches at the beginning of my sermon when I'm trying to get life complicated. I finished the story, but I'm not able to use it as a finish to a sermon as to, oh wow, look at how things have been resolved. I know she sticks her tongue out most of the poem, leaves the room at least, but I'm still stuck in that room.
Okay. And so one of the questions then homiletically is, do sermons have to put periods, or can they end with question marks? I hear you saying period, that homiletically you like questions that lead to periods, but I wonder about strategies that have questions and some periods along the way, but that also leave with maybe a question and, you know, just something to think about. I see your question sort of hanging over your head.
Well,
when I
think about
that.
The book of Jonah ending with a question. That's why I'm
right. Right. Well, in the parables. Think about the parables where, you know, those who have ears, and you're like, I have ears. I don't know what that one meant. Well, that's the way the parables work. Not all of them. So, you know, homiletically, the strategies of these short storytellers, there is a tendency to think of, like when film clips became popular in sermons, people said, these are great for setting up the issue, but then you got to bring the gospel's answer. But I'm not against that strategy. That's a good strategy, but I don't think that's the only one. Because one of the things that movies and literature do so well is they raise the questions, they hint at answers, and they say, there's still a big question, isn't it? And maybe we have a tendency to think theologically, especially as preachers, that we are, well, we graduated from seminary, so we should come with periods and exclamation points, but not question marks. You went to seminary so that you'd have no more question marks. Not hardly. So, I mean, homiletically, I think there's some possibilities. That's not to say, I hear your point on the particulars of this, that's not to say that the sermon has to end with the preacher sticking out his or her tongue, you know, saying, so what do we say to death? You know, or something, I don't know. But what else? Now this is where it's really tricky. We need to talk about this, because one of the techniques of doing this, and I'm trying to take a whole semester here of stuff and tell you this, but is you've got to be able to retell these stories. You've got to be able to retell this story in such a way that someone who has never read it enters into it, feels it, experiences it, catches some sense of its texture, and is moved by it. Because that's the power of these stories. And the way you're doing that, now there's another option. You could say, well, at my church, we distribute a copy of these a week before. Well, you could do that, but not everybody's going to read it. So realistically, though, if I'm going to use this story in a sermon Sunday, how do I retell it? Well, what you have to do is you have to start saying, well, what scenes are revelatory that I have to include? And then, of course, you have to narrow what's the focus of my sermon, to use Long's expression. If my sermon's about X, and this part of the story really chases a rabbit about Y, well, then I've got to do some discernment there. But even if I say it's going to be about, you know, what is the Christian response to terminal illness or death or whatever, what scenes need to be there? You know, do I need to say that she was sitting in a plastic chair and she had three glasses of water? The first one, probably not. But I kind of need to explain her character, don't I? That she's got this kind of somewhat naive but pious belief that there really is goodness. And you know, so I got to kind of do that. And I've got to explain fairly quickly that Mike's skeptic, and I've got to somehow get that relationship to grow warm throughout the retelling, and I got to get in Einstein, you know, if you're going to use that. So there's a real skill involved in retelling a short story like that. The technique I use is I might actually, quote unquote, memorize a couple of lines in the story, but I'm not trying to do the whole story. I'm really trying to do a retelling that is a kind of overview of the whole story and using some of those lines. I've not used this one. I could do a retelling of like an Alice Walker short story. Does anybody know The Welcome Table? Well, here I'll do a retelling of The Welcome Table. Okay, so you don't know it. See if you know it after this. Okay, it's the story of a woman who is nameless and black. And on this particular day, it's a Sunday, and she puts on the finest go-to-meeting clothes she has, which is really the only dress she has. Because as Walker tells us, the color of her skin is like this gray, poor Georgia earth where she was born. And she's been beaten down by sunshine and King Cotton all her life. But on this particular day, it's a beautiful day, so she's going to go to church down the street. This little white church on the corner, and it turns out this church is white in more ways than one. And in fact, all the folks are out, kind of gathered out front as they see her coming, and it looks like she's coming to their church, but that can't be. I mean, she doesn't come to their church. But sure enough, she walks up the step, walks past everybody, all of them kind of speechless. The ushers are supposed to do their job, more like bouncers, they don't say anything. The minister doesn't say anything. And folks watch her as she goes in. She sits down in the back row of the church, and she notices it's kind of cold in there, but she's come to praise Jesus. So she closes her eyes and starts humming and praising and singing songs to Jesus. And finally, the respectable ladies of the church insist that the right thing be done. And their husbands hurl this woman bodily out of the church and throw her down the steps. And she tumbles onto the ground. And whereas just moments ago she was in this church praising God, she's trying to collect herself. And she gets up and she's kind of dusting herself off and she's in shock. And then she gets this big, toothless grin because coming down the road at a firm but leisurely pace is none other than Jesus. I mean, the Jesus. She knows it's Jesus. She's seen his picture in her Bible. And all he says, two words, follow me. She just joins Jesus and she starts walking with him and she's kind of quiet for a few minutes. And then she starts telling about what they did to him back there in his church. And Jesus listens and every once in a while he smiles at her. And the two of them walk on until the ground beneath their feet gives way to clouds and they're home. Now, if you read that short story, it's got a lot more going on than that. I mean, it's several pages long. I think it's actually in this collection as well. And then she adds a little postscript. I can turn to it real quick. Because my retelling, I chose not to do this. Let's see if I can get it. It's coming. This is her little postscript. The people in church never knew what happened to the old woman. They never mentioned her to one another or to anybody else. Most of them heard sometime later that an old colored woman fell dead along the highway. Silly as it seemed, it appeared she had walked herself to death. Many of the black families along the road said that they'd seen the old lady high-stepping down the highway, sometimes jabbering in a low, insistent voice, sometimes singing, sometimes merely gesturing excitedly with her hands, other times silent, smiling, looking at the sky. She had been alone, they said. Some of them wondered aloud where the old woman had been going so stoutly that it had worn her heart out. They guessed maybe she had relatives across the river, some miles away, but none of them really knew. Sort of an indictment on the church there, huh? And it's a pretty powerful story, wouldn't you say? So this retelling is a kind of skill. So if you want to go read that short story, and you can kind of see pieces where I really took word for word from it. Some of those lines were Walker's, and some of those were just sort of mine. And it's just kind of a practice thing, you know, until you get it right. Because if you just kind of do the math, however long the sermon is, this thing can't be the whole sermon. But neither can you do justice to it in, you know, the normal little paragraph or something that some illustrations get. So the role that it takes on in the sermon, you know, like my students will ask this question, they'll say, okay, so you're talking 10 minutes and 10 minutes kind of thing? And I go, okay, this isn't algebra, you know, we're not quite going to be that, you know, anal retentive about it. But you want this short story to do more than a cameo appearance. You want us to enter into it. And here's the great thing. Why don't we enter into this biblical narrative in the same way? Enter into the pathos of it. Enter into the texture of it. And then you get some really creative thoughts. You don't necessarily know how you're going to shape the sermon then. But there's, you know, some options, I guess is the way to say it. What do you think?
Another one of the questions I had for you, and it kind of, as someone who knows short stories, is, and as a preacher, is, you know, is your experience around, or your thoughts around using the short story as the entire sermon?
Yeah.
Juxtapositioning it with the scripture.
There have been preachers to do that. Mm-hmm. Very, very few. There was a sermon back in like 1980 in a book by Richard Jensen called Telling the Story, in which he, in the appendix, put some different, what he called different types of narrative, because narrative was just being born in 1980. And one of those was called The Lonely Lady of Blairstown Park. It wasn't a short story in a published sense, but he wrote this kind of version of The Prodigal Son, but it was pretty well done. I mean, it was disguised. You didn't know right away that it was the prodigal. But there was no mention of Scripture. The whole sermon was this modern story, and then the sermon ended by reading Luke 15. And there's some people who say, perfectly fine doing that. And others say, oh, no, no, no. I hear the voice of my preaching professor in New Testament Cross saying, no, 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 that's not a sermon. You know? And so some people are going to feel the need to do more with the text, both narratively and expositionally. So you're going to have to sort of do your own inventory there. You know, homiletically, theologically, philosophically, what are your views on that? Do you feel like, well, it's not a steady diet. I'm not going to do this every week. John Updike this week and Flannery O'Connor next week. But, you know, maybe you'd say, hey, I don't think once in a while that'd be a bad strategy. Others might say, no, no, no. The preached word should always be, you know, from text and so forth. So you'd have to kind of figure that out yourself. When I do them, I tend to kind of what Lowry would call kind of run the biblical story for a little bit. I mean, in other words, start telling it. Then I sort of switch over and start telling this one, and then I might come back, you know, creative splicing along the way. Or I might just tell the whole thing here and then the whole thing here with one little punchline at the end. You know, there are options, but there are only so many, really, when you start looking at it. I mean, if you've got two things, there are only so many ways you can sort of splice these things together. But it's fun to play with it. Yeah?
Can you talk about the fact that, you know, sermons, you kind of want, well, at least from what I've heard, you know, one thought, one point, you need to have a focus. And the story, it's very complex. I mean, so is the passage that I'm sure that you're preaching on.
Right.
So how do you combine the complexity of the passage, the complexity of the story? I mean, are you trying to pull out maybe one central theme, one incident that really...
Yeah, that'd be my answer, is that, you know, there are some who believe that every text has only one. And then there are others who'd say, no, texts are multifaceted and multivalent. And so there are many options there. So I think the short answer is yes, you have to, even if I wasn't going to use a short story, there's too many things in this text. If it was a Bible study, you know, maybe I can say, oh, and here's another interesting thing. But because of that, it's a sermon that deciding, here's where I'm going to camp out this week. Which means, hardest thing for preachers to do, I'm not going to talk about this, 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 and this. And it's the same because then you're doing the short story is, because I've decided on this focus, this short story could be used for a lot of things. I'm going to narrow my choices and then let these two happen. Yeah,
so and then I can understand why there would be some preaching involved, because you could just tell the story and people will take it wherever they are.
Right.
But if you could direct it to a point or a focus.
Well, when I told Alice Walker, what was the point? I mean, is it obvious or not obvious?
Oh, you mean when you read that story, what was the point?
When I told the Alice Walker story. Welcome table, what was the point of that story?
Exclusion from the church.
She was following the Lord who takes her home, right? I mean, somehow, I don't know how, in literature it can happen, the ground gives way to clouds. I left off the judgmental piece that she ends with. If I were preaching a kind of indictment against the church's racism, well, I wouldn't leave off that last paragraph. The church didn't know where she went. She went to be with Jesus. You know, and so, and it's across the river. You know, you get some imagery there. So the way you decide to preach the text influences the way you retell this and where you're going to camp out. And I personally don't mind that it could start with the story for that matter, because as long as you do good exegetical work. Yes?
The story helps homiletically because it simplifies Job by dividing him into two characters. Job is absolutely convinced of God's goodness.
Right.
He's also absolutely convinced that there must be an answer for the plight that he's in.
Yeah.
So the story helpfully divides those two questions into two different characters.
Yeah.
And I could see spending time in one sermon on one and the next sermon on the other.
Oh, that's good. I wrote my email up here because when you wrote yours down, I'm not sure I can read all of these. And if it comes bouncing back, I won't be able to get you. So if you don't get this from me in a week or so, that's because I couldn't read your email address. So maybe you can read mine. And so you can send me one if you don't get it. Thank you very much. Enjoy it.
Thank you.